Cairo will talk about innovations in mine land management that have led to ecological restoration. The Buck Lake Improvement Club, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk, has a bingo event Saturday, January 17th. Doors open at 12:30 with games starting at 1. Lunch is available for purchase. Chair has a free community meal Sunday, January 18th at their location on Chestnut Street in downtown Virginia from noon to 3. The event also offers food and clothing distribution to those in need. If you have items to donate, you may bring them to Chair at any time. Lake Bemidji State Park offers two events for kids Monday, January 19th at 10 a.m. It's Winter Nature Art, where kids can make masterpieces out of the natural world. At 2 o'clock, it's Snowtastic Science. Explore science behind snow and make a snow volcano. Dress for the weather. Park admission is free this day. The Grand Rapids Community Diabetes Support Group meets Thursday, January 22nd at 7 p.m. at the YMCA Active Living Center. This month's topic is medication therapy management.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. President Trump is promoting new ideas for dealing with concerns voters have about affordability. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Trump visited a truck plant in Michigan yesterday.
Trump's speech in Detroit lasted more than an hour and included a lot of commentary that had nothing to do with the economy. But on the matter of bringing down the cost of living, Trump talked about his recent pitch to have credit card companies cap interest rates at 10% for a year.
Because they're getting 28 and 30% and 32%. And it's unfair. The rates are way too high.
Trump even called Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren this week. She said she told him capping credit card rates would require congressional action and he would have to fight for it. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
In Iran, activists say more than 2,400 protesters have been killed in demonstrations around the country over economic issues. Thousands have been arrested after authorities launched a brutal crackdown to stem the dissent that started 3 weeks ago. Mahmoud Amiri Magadam is with the Norway-based Iran Human Rights Group.
Thousands of people have been killed on the streets, and some injured people have been shot afterwards. The international community must send a very strong signal because it seems that they are crossing one red line after the other.
Speaking there to the BBC, President Trump has warned Iran against executing protesters, saying the U.S. may take military action. This as the head of the country's judiciary today signaled there would be fast trials and executions for those detained. A new global study of generative AI in schools finds that the risks outweigh the benefits, at least for now. NPR's Corey Turner has more.
The study comes from the Brookings Institution's Center for Universal Education, and it included interviews with students, parents, educators, and tech experts in 50 countries, as well as a review of hundreds of research articles. The authors found that generative AI can help teachers save time and could make access to education more equitable, but that those benefits don't currently outweigh the harms. The study found that when students use AI to do their work for them, it can actually stunt their cognitive development, and the use of chatbots, designed to always agree with users, is stunting kids' social and emotional growth, making engagement with AI feel preferable to the messier give-and-take of human engagement. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Despite President Trump's tariffs on the country, China says it recorded the world's biggest trade surplus at $1.2 trillion. That's a 20% jump from 2024 as Chinese companies continue to pivot away from U.S. consumers and focus on others. This is NPR. Claudette Colvin, who was arrested in 1955 for not giving up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama city bus, has died at the age of 86. Troy Public Radio's Kyle Gassett reports Colvin was one of a number of African Americans who were arrested for violating the law before Rosa Parks.
She was 15, and in her words, glued to the seat of the city bus she was riding when the driver told her to give it up for a white passenger. Like Parks would be 9 months later, Colvin was arrested. But her case would not be the one used to challenge segregation on city buses. In an interview with Radio Diaries, Colvin reflected on the decision made by Montgomery's civil rights leaders.
They thought I would have been too militant for them. They wanted someone mild and genteel like Rosa.
After her arrest, Claudette Colvin was placed on indefinite probation by the city. 6 decades later, in 2021, she successfully petitioned to have her record expunged. For NPR News, I'm Kyle Gassett in Montgomery, Alabama.
Saks Global, the parent company of luxury stores Saks Fifth Avenue, Neiman Marcus, and Bergdorf Goodman, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. This as the privately held company struggles with billions of dollars in debt after acquiring Neiman Marcus in 2024 for $2.6 billion and also amid slowing sales and a deteriorating relationship with its vendors. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
I'm Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXE. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Again, that's psa@kaxe.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington.
Jaime Martinez in Culver City, California. At least six federal prosecutors in Minnesota have quit.
The six have one big reason. Justice Department officials pressured them to twist the investigation of a shooting in Minneapolis. Rather than focus on the federal agent who shot Renee Macklin Good in the head, political leaders wanted an investigation to find dirt on Good's widow. The resignations have disrupted other federal probes, such as an investigation of social service fraud the Trump administration says it cares about.
Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik has been covering both the fraud cases and the shooting death. Matt, why did the six attorneys resign?
The attorneys aren't speaking publicly, but there are several reasons, according to a source with knowledge of the situation. That person asked that we not use their name because they're not authorized to talk to the media. One of those reasons is tied to last week's fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Macklin Good by ICE agent Jonathan Ross. Trump administration officials say the agent fired in self-defense, but many state and local officials are pointing to video taken from multiple angles that contradicts claims that Good posed any threat. The person with knowledge of the situation I spoke with says there's pressure from DOJ leaders to investigate Good's widow, Becca Good, for ties to activist groups, which is not illegal. The group also objects to the DOJ's reluctance to investigate Agent Ross and to exclude state police from the investigation. And the same source tells me that the veteran prosecutors are concerned that Trump's focus on immigration has drawn resources away from the fraud investigations.
Yeah, you mentioned their veteran prosecutors, been around a while. What's significant about their decision?
Well, it's a loss of big talent. The attorneys spent their careers with the Justice Department and prosecuted many major cases. One of them is Melinda Williams, an assistant U.S. attorney who led the criminal division here. Another is Joe Thompson. He's been key in the government's prosecution of fraud, particularly the infamous Feeding Our Future case. Thompson charged 78 people with stealing around $300 million from federal child nutrition programs during the pandemic. 58 have been convicted. convicted. Investigators also uncovered massive Medicaid fraud. Last month, Thompson estimated that around $9 billion may have been stolen.
Taxpayers deserve to know the truth of the fraud. The fraud is not small. It isn't isolated. The magnitude cannot be overstated.
The convicted food fraud ringleader is white, but nearly all of the other defendants are Somali American. Even though the majority are U.S. citizens, President Trump is using the fraud as a pretext for his immigration crackdown.
I would imagine leaders in Minnesota have a lot to say about these resignations.
Yeah, they do. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, a Democrat, is calling the prosecutors heroes. In a statement, he adds, quote, "The people pushing to prosecute Renee's widow are monsters." And U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar, also a Democrat and a former prosecutor herself, says DOJ is politicizing the investigation into Good's killing.
The first way they did it was cutting out the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. That was such a bad sign that there was more bad to come, because our Minnesota Bureau has seasoned professionals. They've always worked together, and they cut them out.
What about the Justice Department, Matt? What are they saying?
Assistant Attorney General Todd Blanche says in a short statement, quote, "There is currently no basis for a criminal civil rights investigation. The DOJ tells me ICE is running its own investigation that's parallel to, quote, any FBI investigation." But the same source not authorized to speak on the record calls that a lie and says ICE is not investigating the shooting.
That's Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Ankush Kadoria is with us next. He's a former federal prosecutor in the Department of Justice during Trump's first term and now writes about national legal issues for Politico. Good morning.
Morning.
What message does it send when a federal agent shoots someone in the head and the focus of the investigation is not the agent but the background of somebody who was nearby who was talking back to the agent?
Look, we are very, very far afield from normal rules of the road here and how this should be operating. Senator Klobuchar is exactly right. None of this is on the level. This appears to be a wholly politicized investigation. It is entirely backwards. I mean, I think every American, every person who has seen some of those videos can recognize the absurdity of not even investigating the law enforcement officer who shot this poor woman, and instead focusing on the widow. It is offensive, and it is simply not designed to produce a just outcome. It is apparently designed to serve the political interests of the White House. And I think it's more evidence, not that there's been any shortage of it over the last year, but it's more evidence that this Justice Department has really been absorbed into a sort of a political instrument of the White House on the biggest and most important issues.
We should be clear here. If they did an investigation of the agent, they might well find he was legally justified. The law tends to lean very much in favor of law enforcement in these cases, but they're not investigating so far as we know. Does the Justice Department have any legal or ethical obligation to at least look into the shooting?
I think absolutely they do. I mean, there's a potential crime on video, to your point. We don't know what the outcome of the independent and credible investigation would be. That is an important point to preserve. But, you know, there's no situation in which, you know, a shooting like this should begin, an investigation should begin with the widow and not be focused on the shooter, at least in the first instance, to assess that person's actions and the reasonableness of those actions. And the fact that they haven't even brought the officer into the ambit of the investigation is a very, very big signal that they're not interested in investigating, much less charging him if charges were appropriate. And, you know, they seem to want a political outcome.
Is this a signal to other agents they can open fire?
It is. It is. Unfortunately, look, one of the things that an investigation like this, when done correctly and is focused on the officer and potentially even generates a prosecution, one of the objectives is deterrence. It's deterrence, all right? And that proposition applies to a situation just like this just as much as it applies to shoplifting or murder or financial fraud. We investigate and prosecute cases because they have deterrent value as well as punitive value as well. So yes, certainly at the margins, this is going to incentivize more behavior like this.
I want people to know, if they don't, you served in Trump's first term, then resigned during that term, just as these prosecutors seem to have resigned in Minnesota. Is it a hard choice, hard to be in that situation?
Look, for me, it was hard. The issue that I confronted was not nearly as salient, high profile, or even consequential. It was a difficult decision, though, and I'm sure this was a very difficult decision for these people, too, because as a lawyer, even a lawyer for the government, you know, there's a wide range of professional actions that you can undertake that are reasonable. And you may not entirely agree with the direction that your office is taking, but if the direction is, you know, within the bounds of risk, professional reasonable judgment, that's acceptable. There are situations, however, I confronted one, it seems like these attorneys have confronted one of their own, where you are being asked to do something that is outside of the bounds of reasonable prosecutorial discretion. And I'm sure it's difficult for them personally, but I would imagine on principle, they're feeling perfectly fine about it, because honestly, there are not many better reasons to quit your job as a prosecutor than this one.
I wonder if I could ask your advice. Maybe we shouldn't say legal advice, although you're a lawyer, but I just like your perspective on this. We've had reports of agents walking around demanding that people prove their citizenship. But I should be clear, these reports are of masked gunmen walking around demanding citizenship papers of some kind. And that leads to my question. If a masked gunman demands my identification, do I have a right to demand that they first properly identify themselves and show their face?
This is a very complicated question, and actually I don't want to be out giving advice like this. It's a very fact-specific situation. People need to be very careful about their own personal safety first and foremost, and a situation like that is going to be very fact and context specific. Your legal rights are available to you, and you may assert them in a later legal proceeding, but the first and most important thing to do is to maintain your sense of safety, physical safety at that point. So you should do what you think is appropriate to get you out of the situation. In terms of your legal rights, you can exercise those plenty on the back end through the filing of lawsuits or the like. But in terms of whether you have a right to demand identification from a federal agent in a situation like that, it can vary depending on which agency they're even affiliated with. So again, I would just encourage people to be cautious and to focus on their own safety, particularly in a situation like this where things are really on edge, largely as a result of the government's own conduct.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it. It's been on my mind, and I wanted to hear that perspective. We've been watching in recent days videos of people saying, show your face, show me your identification, and people get arrested when they do that, at least according to the videos that we've seen. You alluded to the Justice Department being turned into a political tool of the White House, and I want to take an extra moment here, if you have it, to dig into that, because these resignations that we've seen in Minnesota are among many. Many people have been fired. Many people have been dismissed from the very first days of the administration. Many people have resigned. Even U.S. attorneys appointed by the president have stepped back rather than do things that they have been ordered to do. Looking at it from the outside, but having once been on the inside, how much has the Justice Department changed for better or worse over the past year?
There has been a very, very significant change, and it has been for the worse over the last year. In fact, the pace and the breadth of the change exceeded my expectations, and my expectations were not positive going into this administration. We have seen a year of Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, and Todd Blanche, the Deputy Attorney General, just fully willing to do what the White House demands of them, requests of them in terms of prosecuting their political opponents. They've hollowed out major components of the department focused on things like financial fraud and other things, redirecting those resources to immigration. The rhetoric coming from the leaders is political and partisan and unprofessional. And I think, you know, over the course of the last year, we've seen plenty of this. This is a continuation of this trend, and I do think it is going to continue for the foreseeable future, unfortunately.
Ankush Kadori is a former federal prosecutor, now a senior writer for Politico. Thanks for the extra time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'll be here until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch is for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. Tune in Saturday at 1:30 and Sunday morning at 10:30. Deep Portage Learning Center in Hackensack has their annual Winter Rendezvous Saturday, January 24th. Enjoy a day of outdoor winter activities such as axe throwing, snow snakes, and more. Registration begins at 9 a.m. with games until 2 and a chili feed at noon. Find more info at deep-portage.org. Rainier Nordic Ski Club invites you to the Lumberjack Jaunt Saturday, January 24th at Northland Arboretum. Choose from skate or classic with distances of 6 or 16 kilometers. A free kids race is also offered. Find more info and register at BrainerdNordicSkiClub.com. January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota connects youth who have been exploited to safe housing, resources, and non-judgmental support. Help is available 24 hours a day at 866-824-3770. Now we're going to take you back to Morning Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From UKG, committed to making work, work. Their HR, pay, and workforce management tools strive to help business leaders build trust and empower their people. More at UKG.com/work. And from Progressive Insurance, building a career is possible at Progressive Insurance. Now offering virtual and hybrid employment opportunities with pathways for advancement. Learn more at careers.progressive.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Yousef Yazdi is just back from Iran, and he has a rare first-person account of the protests sweeping that country. Yazdi is a professor at Johns Hopkins University and the son of Iranian parents. As a frequent visitor to Iran, he's seen many waves of protest. As long ago as 2009, he was on this program talking about the wave of demonstrations back then. I went back and just now and listened to the interview. That was a very different time.
Yes, yes, but in some ways similar.
I was having the same thought even as you spoke those words. I want to play a little clip from that 2009 interview.
The fact that people are actually expressing their anger and their frustration with the situation they're in is a very positive sign. It shows that the people have reached a point where they've developed a level of maturity and a level of fearlessness that they're willing to really stand up for their rights.
That was your feeling in 2009. What do you think about when you hear that sound today?
Wow. Such a hopeful time. And now a lot of that has turned to just absolute anger, indignation, and almost revulsion. So the feelings have grown a lot stronger over the last 20 years, and because nothing has, you know, the regime has just failed in every way possible.
Yousef Yazdi visited Iran over the holidays to check on his mother. She lives in Tehran. He quickly felt the country's economic crisis. The currency value slid to a record low, and inflation remained high. His mother's caretaker said people had stopped buying milk to protest the price, and then more serious protests spread into the streets.
In the neighborhood where my mother's house is, there is a large square there and a large group were gathering there. I could hear them, and I went out at 8 p.m. on Thursday night to join them and to observe.
What did you see?
It was about 200-300 young people mainly, a few older folks like me, and then mostly younger people. And they're very peaceful, chanting slogans, mostly, you know, death to the dictator. And there were a few little more mission-driven people, I would say. Maybe five people in that crowd that really were trying to lead chants, facing the riot police, and they pulled some pavers up from the sidewalk and started throwing them at the riot police, and then the riot police responded with tear gas.
You're describing this all very calmly, but it must have been a very tense moment.
It was. They first shined the laser, green laser pointers or sights on us, and then one young lady standing next to me was, the laser landed on her shirt, and she thought she had been shot or something. She was freaking out. So that it was a matter of a lot of fear, because these are young people, incredibly fierce, brave, strong, but very naive to this sort of thing, and they're no match for either trained riot police or trained agitators who want to escalate the violence.
And what weapons or tools do the riot police use when they responded, other than the lasers?
They have batons, and they have tear gas launchers as their main thing. They have these, CS gas, tear gas canister launchers, and they can fire them hundreds of feet. So they use those a lot. And one of the protesters picked up the tear gas and threw it. And it's hot because it has projectile, stuff in it like a firecracker to make it fly in the air. So he bravely went up and did that.
Did you get a face full of this?
Yes, I did. I did. I made the mistake of breathing a bit through my mouth, which you kids, lesson learned, never breathe through your mouth if you're experiencing tear gas attack, because your throat will burn for days. It's still kind of irritated.
Having witnessed so many protests before that the current government endured, did you come away feeling that the current government was in any particular danger of falling?
I it seemed like a government that has run out of steam. I couldn't find anybody that has anything nice to say about the way things are being run, whether they're pro-government or anti-government. But the government does have some tools in its arsenal, and one of those is, I think they benefit from the escalation of violence. For example, in one of the squares in the city near my mother's house, a major, very beautiful mosque was burned down. The square was trashed, and the government just plays those video clips ad nauseum on the state media. There's a video clip of somebody setting a riot cop on fire, throwing stones. The escalation of violence really plays into their hands, and the government benefits from that, because if the protests were nonviolent, I think the crowds would be 100 times larger, 1,000 times larger. But people are hesitant, and I think the hardliners know that they have pretty much the monopoly on street violence, and they can win that battle. But if it's a nonviolent protest, the government will lose. The power will be more in the hands of the people.
I'm fascinated by this detail. You clearly seem to have your heart on the side of the protesters, but you're saying you did not agree with the tactics of those who pried up the stones and threw them at police and caused that to become a more and more violent moment.
Yeah, it absolutely does not help. I mean, it's one thing to sit in the United States and encourage Trump or Netanyahu to drop bombs, encourage sanctions. It's another thing when you live in that country and you're going to be the one on the receiving end of the economic troubles or the bombs, and you're going to be the collateral damage. I think it's a totally different dynamic. That's why I strongly believe that what Americans should do and the U.S. government should do is support those brave people there in the country who are in prison. There's plenty of leaders, including one who won a Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years ago, who are there bravely speaking out, presenting practical solutions. And they're the ones who I think we should be supporting, because people on the outside, there's a natural tendency that if you're far away from the conflict to just be a little bit higher level of tolerance for violence when you're not the ones getting bombed.
Yusuf Yazdi, thanks very much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
Yusuf Yazdi, Johns Hopkins professor and frequent visitor to Iran. The protest he experienced was on Thursday night, just as a crackdown intensified and the government choked off the internet. Despite that effort at a blackout, a U.S.-based group called the Human Rights Activists News Agency has accumulated information about casualties, and the group says more than 2,400 protesters have been killed in recent days. NPR has not been able to independently verify those numbers. This is NPR News.
What will the ousting of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela mean for the future of the oil industry?
If you're benefiting the U.S. economy, it's probably to the detriment of someone, potentially Venezuela.
I'm Juana Summers. We go to Texas, which has the most refining capacity in the United States, for answers on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Yeah.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I am your host this morning, and it's just me this morning. So just giving you a heads up that you're going to get a lot of Andrew this morning. For some, that might be good news. For some, maybe not so great news. But you know what? We're going to get through this together, and I am going to ask for you, the listener, to help me out this morning. If there's a movie you've recently seen that you want to talk about, go ahead and text me about it. If there's an album you've listened to recently that you want to talk about, text me about that. Let's get a conversation going this morning. I would love to hear from you. Text in at 218-326-1234. I'm here until 9 o'clock before I hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters, which we have a special edition of Headwaters going on this morning, because there is going to be a live session with Longville folk singer Charlie Wagner at 10:15 this morning. So stay tuned for that. Support for KAXE comes from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. We receive support from Sanford Bemidji Family Medicine Team, providing care to the whole family from birth to the golden years. More at bemidji.sanfordhealth.org. And looking at the weather today, it was very chilly when I went into my car this morning, but today should be sunny with highs near 12 degrees, northwest winds 15 to 20 miles per hour, so it is going to be windy. Tonight, slight chance of snow in the morning, increasing clouds, lows near 2 degrees, south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Thursday, snow likely, mostly cloudy, highs 27 to 32 degrees, south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, evening lows around 12 degrees, and then Friday, patchy blowing snow before noon, highs near 32 degrees, northwest winds 18 to 22 miles per hour. Also, we have quite the morning show planned for you. We got my regular Airy Voices segment coming up later in this morning. We're going to be talking with some people from the Central Lakes College Performing Arts Center, talking about the upcoming stage reading of The Pillow Man. And then also we are going to be talking about Back to Hack, the Hackensack Festival that's going on this weekend. And we're going to be talking about all the events going on and kind of the history of Back to Hack. That's going to be coming up around 7:40 this morning. And then around 8:10, the Bemidji Downtown Lions is planning a chocolate walk on Valentine's Day. Now, what exactly is a chocolate walk? Well, that's what we're going to find out. So you're going to want to tune in around 8:10 this morning. And also, remember, we have our question of the week. What are your favorite games? You can text us at 218-326-1234. We're looking for card games, board games, perhaps a video game. I used to play video games. Well, I still do play video games, but now I am a mostly Tetris player. That's basically all I play anymore, because here's the thing about Tetris. It is a simple game, but it's so well crafted. Like, I was talking about this with another person the other day. If they made a list of like the 100 greatest video games of all time and they put Tetris at number one, I feel like nobody could argue with that, because it is an endlessly playable game and it's always going to be different every time you play. And it's got the puzzle aspect to it as well. The version I play, you play against 99 other people who see who can last the longest. And then you can, like, every row you get, you send blocks to somebody else. It's a really fun game. But, yeah, let me know if you're a Tetris fan out there. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The United States Supreme Court has once again declined to take up challenges to a federal law that protects subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. The court rejected the state of Alaska's petition to review a federal lawsuit against the state over salmon management on the Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has more.
The state had argued the federal government was misinterpreting a law Congress passed to protect a rural priority for subsistence. Last year, after the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with federal fishery managers, the state asked the Supreme Court to take up the case. But in a court docket on Monday, the Supreme Court denied the state's petition. The Alaska Federation of Natives hailed the decision. Its president, Ben Mallott, says decades of hard-won protections under the landmark Katie John lawsuits were also on the line.
I feel relieved that we don't have to spend our limited resources and efforts fighting for what we know is right. Hopefully, our final time protecting what Katie John fought for.
John was an Otna Athabascan elder who fought for the right to fish on rivers that flow through federal lands. This is the third time the Supreme Court has decided to let Katie John litigation stand untouched. Alaska's Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang said in a statement that the state will respect the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court to not address legal issues regarding fish and game management authorities over navigable waters belonging to the state of Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Mary Peltola, a Yupik Democrat and the first Alaska Native person elected to Congress, announced Monday that she's running for U.S. Senate, taking on Republican incumbent Dan Sullivan. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Peltola served one partial and one full term in the U.S. House, then narrowly lost her seat in 2024. Her initial campaign videos portrayed her salmon-centered family life on the Kuskokwim River. She talks about the high cost of housing and groceries. She doesn't mention Sullivan by name.
The politicians representing us on Capitol Hill are more interested in appealing to D.C. partisans than to the Alaskans who elected them.
Nationally, Democrats believe that with Peltola on the ballot, Alaska presents one of their best hopes of flipping a Senate seat. Sullivan has already raised $6 million this election cycle. He has President Trump's endorsement and maintains a strong alignment with Trump. The National Republican Senatorial Committee and other groups supporting Sullivan issued a string of press releases. They link her to Joe Biden and other national figures on the left. Some Republican messages hit at her high rate of missed House votes. Peltola tried to head off that last point in her launch video, saying D.C. people were shocked that she went home in July to put up fish for her family. But she says Alaskans understand. For U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Peltola's candidacy presents a dilemma. They're both moderates, and Murkowski endorsed Peltola in the past, despite their party differences. Thursday, Murkowski said she'd made a decision.
We want to figure out how we're going to keep in the majority, and Dan delivers that.
So you would endorse Dan?
You know, yes, I am. I guess I'm saying that I am endorsing my Republican partner.
I'm Liz Ruskin.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Colonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up in a bit, we're going to hear more from Morning Edition, talking about NPR is going to talk about Walmart shopping cart and sick astronaut heads home. So that's going to be coming up in just a bit. And I was talking about Tetris, and we heard from our very own engineer, Steve. Yes, Tetris 99 is pretty cool. The best Tetris I played a while back was on the Wii. Four people playing simultaneously, but not in each of their own well. We were all in the same well, dodging each other's pieces, just trying to survive. So that sounds like a lot of fun because, yeah, you got to avoid each other. And he also added, if we're talking about favorite video games, I've been a fan of the Metroid series since the first game in 1987. I have played every game in the franchise, and in my opinion, there's not a single dud in the lot. So, Steve, I have an interesting, well, interesting is a very strong word, but I have a story. So as a child, you go to, especially growing up in the 90s, there was a lot more, what's the word I'm looking for, like promotion for video games at stores like Walmart and Target. And, you know, when you go, when you're a kid, like maybe 7 or 8 years old, for some reason you get in your head that if you hang around in the video game section and you look sad enough, maybe someone will feel sorry for you and buy a video game for you at the store. I don't know where that idea comes from, but it seems to be like a universal feeling for kids of a certain age that if you look sad, maybe someone will buy you a video game. And the video game I wanted really bad was Super Metroid for the Super Nintendo and never got it. Dealt with that for lots of years, went to therapy and whatnot. But a few years ago, they released the Super Nintendo Classics console, where it was a mini Super Nintendo and it had a bunch of the old games on there. And it had Super Metroid on there. So I finally got to play it. I made it pretty far in the game, but then lost interest because of maybe it was COVID, I think. So, which you would think I would have had more time to play it, but well, that's how it goes sometimes. But I never finished the game, and I think I should go back to redo it all and finally finish the game. Complete this lifelong journey I've been going through. So thank you, Steve. If you have a game you want to talk about, text us at 218-326-1234. Support for KAXE comes from the Northwoods Pond Hockey Championship, taking place Saturday, February 14th on McKinney Lake in Grand Rapids. Featuring food trucks, live music, and an open skating rink for skaters of all ages, the event is open to all spectators, with more information at northwoodspondhockey.com. Are you a local business owner? You can have an impact on the future of KAXE and keep people-powered radio strong with your sponsorship dollars. Visit kaxe.org/give to learn about sponsorship options. A big thank you to all our current business sponsors. Now we're going to hear more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. All right, let's talk about prices. For years now, NPR has tracked prices at the same Walmart in Georgia every December. It's a way to find out how the pandemic, inflation, and now tariffs are affecting what people pay. NPR's Alina Selyuk just got back from her latest trip there, where she shopped for over 100 items. All right, just to start, I mean, how long does it take to buy 100 things?
Hi. It's actually 114 items.
Okay.
It takes hours. My colleague Connie Hansung Jin and I walked almost every aisle of a Walmart supercenter south of Savannah.
Here's your party size plastic chips, 13 ounces.
How much was it before?
$5.44.
It's the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's an example of a price check on one type of potato chips. Now imagine us doing that process again and again with t-shirts, shampoo, dog food, pork chops. And the headline is that almost half the items in NPR's shopping cart got more expensive in 2025.
Oh, more expensive. Okay, so what were the biggest price increases?
I think it's what you might suspect. Beef, coffee, and chocolate. You've probably heard about these items. We have a shortage of beef in the U.S., and there's a global shortage of coffee and cocoa beans. And the culprit there is largely extreme weather and climate change, droughts, and floods. And by the way, you can see our full analysis online. It's at npr.org/shoppingcart.
Okay, so what did you see in Georgia about the impact of President Trump's tariffs?
So it's hard to pin any price increase on tariffs with certainty. Even with beef and coffee I just mentioned, tariffs played a role. But some of the biggest price jumps we saw were on paper folders made in China, measuring spoons made in China, seafood made from Vietnam, or a bike helmet that used to be made in China and is now made in Vietnam. I should note that I reached out to every company making the items that changed in price, and many of them did not respond, but some did, like Reynolds, which makes aluminum foil. That went up in price by 13%, and Reynolds cited historic cost increases for the aluminum market, like energy and tariffs. Much of the aluminum used in the U.S. comes from Canada. Or I heard from Dole, which makes canned pineapple. It went up in price by 25%, and the company cited weather-related crop shortages in Southeast Asia and tariffs on goods from the region.
Okay, now you did the shopping, as we mentioned, in a Walmart. Did Walmart say anything?
I asked about individual price increases, and Walmart, in a statement, said its dedicated goal is to have the lowest price on a basket of goods over time. So that probably means, you know, maybe the store raises one price, but then lowers some others to balance it out, that sort of thing. On tariffs, early on, Walmart was saying that they were raising company costs every week. But then the White House reduced and delayed so many tariffs that in November, Walmart executives said the tariffs had less impact than they had feared. The company absorbed some of the costs. It pushed its suppliers to do the same. And I did notice at the store that Walmart was definitely offering a lot more discounts this time compared to years past.
Oh, okay. There's some good news right there. Discounts aside, though, what else got cheaper?
Eggs, finally.
Eggs!
We got a bit of a break from the persistent bird flu, and the price of a dozen eggs fell 30%. Also, the price of butter declined. That's because of a glut in dairy production. And we saw an unusual sign in the packaged foods aisle. If you remember that bag of chips we price checked, its cost did not change. Prices on a lot of snacks and cereals stayed the same after years of going up. Cheerios actually got cheaper by 19%. Its maker, General Mills, has said that it's in the process of lowering prices on two-thirds of its products. That's a response to shoppers tightening budgets. Companies are feeling it, and we saw them respond.
I was about to buy a rooster and a chicken and make my own eggs, Alina, but I will stop now. I won't do that. That's NPR.
That's a really expensive project.
I know. Thanks for shopping.
Thank you.
Some Cheerios this morning. I'm feeling smart. An astronaut with a serious medical concern is expected to head home from space today. Astronauts had been planning to remain on the International Space Station until next month, until the U.S. Space Agency cut their mission short. First time in the station's 25 years in orbit that a medical concern sent astronauts home early. The exact nature of this medical issue has not been disclosed for privacy reasons, but we do know something about the challenges of diagnosis in space. Here's NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce.
Stephen Moll is a doctor with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill who specializes in treating blood clots and bleeding disorders. A few years ago, his home phone rang and the caller ID flashed the words International Space Station. His wife said jokingly, "Oh, look, outer space is calling."
Not fully realizing, yes, this is indeed a call from outer space.
Moll was working with NASA to help an astronaut on the station who faced a tricky situation. While doing a basic research study on how blood flows in microgravity, this astronaut had used an ultrasound wand to scan blood vessels, like the ones in the neck. These scans got sent back to Earth, where the researchers looked them over.
And when they did this, there is something in the left internal jugular vein. The vein that leads blood away from the brain.
It looked like a blood clot, and a blockage in that major vein could be serious for the astronaut. Blood could back up into the brain and cause stroke-like symptoms, or the clot could travel to the lung. Trouble is, no one knew how likely any of that was. This kind of clot is uncommon on Earth, to say nothing of space. Moll talked all this over with NASA's flight surgeons and on the phone with the astronaut in orbit.
They're just normal people up there. They're just a little in a different environment, but it comes down to the same concerns that other patients have.
About the risks and possible options, that astronaut ended up staying on the station and taking a blood-thinning drug. Luckily, a limited amount of the medicine just happened to be up there. While it's unclear what kind of health issue NASA's dealing with now, crews do get trained for medical emergencies. The agency even has plans for what to do if an astronaut dies in orbit. But the station's stockpile of pharmaceuticals and diagnostics is far more limited than what you'd find in an emergency room. James Polk is NASA's chief health and medical officer. He says they want to be able to do a full diagnostic workup on this astronaut with a medical concern.
And the best way to complete that workup is on the ground, where we have the full suite of medical testing hardware.
He said the astronaut's condition was stable. A video beamed down from the station on Monday featured all seven people on board, and no one appeared obviously ill. NASA astronaut Zena Cardman is on the crew that will be coming home early.
Our timing of this departure is unexpected, but what was not surprising to me was how well this crew came together as a family to help each other and just take care of each other.
If all goes as planned, she and her crewmates will arrive back on Earth early Thursday morning in a SpaceX capsule. Their replacements will go up next month. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle. And coming up in a bit, we are going to have the Up North Report, local news from our region. So one thing we like to do on the Wednesday Morning Show is look at the National Day calendar. And let's see, what are we looking at today? National Dress Up Your Pet Day. Interesting. So I've never really had pets. I've lived with pets, but they were never like my pets, so I wasn't in my position to be dressing up any pets at all. But I'm curious what the listener feedback here would be. Do you dress up your pet? I know like sometimes like some dogs, when they're like short haired, people will give them like coats so they're like not freezing cold or whatever. I'm just curious, do you dress up your pet, especially for Halloween? If you have Halloween pictures of your pets, please send them my way. That's 218-326-1234. And then the other one today is National Hot Pastrami Sandwich Day. Now, this may be surprising, but I've never actually had a pastrami sandwich. And, you know, I hear about it in movies a lot. It seems to be a popular food to mention in movies and TV shows. So one day I would like to have a pastrami sandwich. I think I could get along with a pastrami sandwich. Curious what you think. Let us know. 218-326-1234. Do you think Andrew DeZingle would like a pastrami sandwich? We'd love to hear from you. All right, we're going to play a tune for you now. This is David Gray from his album White Ladder, which this album, I think, is more influential than the credit it gets. There was definitely a wave of artists that were starting kind of doing the mixture of acoustic guitar, but also like kind of a little electronic beat to the songs as well. But it, for better or worse, gave us artists like James Blunt, Daniel Powder, I feel like, especially during that, what I like to call VH1 bands of the 2000s. But this album, White Ladder, definitely holds up. This song I'm about to play for you definitely holds up. It's my favorite song on the album. This is David Gray with Please Forgive Me.
Forgive me if I act a little strange, for I know not what I do. Feels like lightning running through my veins every time I look at you. Every time I me out here, all my words are falling short, and there's so much I want to say. Want to tell you just how good it feels when you look at me that way. When you look at me that way. Throw a stone and watch the ripples flow, moving out across the bay. So mystery. please forgive me if I act a little strange. For I know not what I do. Feels like lightning running through my veins every time I look at you. Every time I look at you. Every time I look at you. Every time I look at you.
And that was David Gray with Please Forgive Me from his classic album White Ladder. Absolutely love that song. There is a terrific live video on YouTube, him performing that song. And the drummer on it is fantastic. How fast he is playing the drums is so impressive. It gave me goosebumps when I first watched it. So highly recommend it. That song again was David Gray with Please Forgive Me. So it's National Pastrami Sandwich Day today, and I put out the question there, should I eat a pastrami sandwich one day? And we heard from Noah and Britt, you definitely need to get yourself a pastrami sandwich. Dude, you're a big boy now. Thank you, Noah. But don't go crazy with the nitrates. I will try not to. So, yeah, you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm going to be joined in a bit by Heather Johnson, and we are going to be your two hosts this morning until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. And like I said, we've got quite the show still planned for you this morning. Around 7:40 this morning, we're going to be talking about Back in Hack, the winter traditional festival that happens in Hackensack every week. We got to talk a little bit on the Monday morning show, talking about some events going on, including Frost and Flannel event going on in the Bright Spot, which you can read more about on the website, KAXE.org. Then later in the show, we're going to be talking about the Chocolate Walk that's going to be going on Valentine's Day in downtown Bemidji. I am as curious as you as what a chocolate walk entails. I've got a lot of great ideas of what a chocolate walk could be. We'll see if any of them come true. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. And we receive support from AW Research Laboratories, located in Brainerd, providing water testing for private wells, real estate, lakes, and wastewater since 1972. Online at awlab.com. And this is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio.